So of course, in the exoplanets, there's an implicit exoplanets here also. I'm not going to cite myself throughout the presentation. You can look up my name, and these collaborators, they'll find the papers on the subjects that I'm talking about. So here we have the exoplanets as dots in the solar system planets. Out here, a large period and small eccentricity. And it's quite puzzling that there's a huge number of planets down here at three-day periods, the hot Jupiters.
This is a radial velocity sample, and the bump shows up. So the bump really became apparent around the same time that the transiting planets were starting to be discovered. But it's not a selection effect. It shows up just in the radial velocities too. And there's no strong reason why there should be that bump from the observations. It's probably real. So I think that hot Jupiters, if you can see over the podium here, hot Jupiters are a subclass, and they exist close to the star for some reason. It might be migration through a disk has a stopping mechanism that turns on really close to the star. Or it could be because of tides, which we're talking about this week. So this is the route you'd expect for disk migration, coming in from the ice line on low eccentricity, probably low eccentricity the whole way. Or maybe there's a different route where some process among several bodies pumps up the eccentricity, and the scale of hot Jupiters is set by where the barycenter distance makes tides important. So here are lines of constant angular momentum. If only the tide in the planet matters, then you're going to follow one of these lines down towards the star, because the spin of the planet can't hold very much angular momentum. So if only the tide in the planet dissipates, you'll slide down one of those to become a hot Jupiter at very small eccentricity. So this is, I think, a completely valid way to make a three-day hot Jupiter. And we're just starting to get some inkling of the inclination distribution. And so the inclinations relative to the stellar equator might distinguish these. The disk migration would likely give you an aligned spin orbit, and something that gives you such an enormous eccentricity, it's hard to imagine it wouldn't give you some
inclination also. So
it's likely this other route would give you misalignment. So I'll come back to that at the end. And in the meantime, I'll talk about the evolution. And again, these are maybe some of you have heard a lot of this material before. I've been talking about it for a couple of years now. So feel free to interrupt, especially at the KITP. It's the KITP way, says Adam. Okay, so
I was just channeling David Gross.
Right. So you have the orbital angular momentum is, of course, normal to the plane of the orbit, and the spin angular
angular momenta
are labeled here too. So just because the bodies are rotating, they're going to have rotational bulges, which are oblate at the equator. And this is just a quick review, because we've had three tidal talks already. In the gravitational tide of the star, that causes the spin of the planet's orbit to precess about its orbit. And it will be, if no other forces are acting, with a constant obliquity theta. So, but there's also a tidal bulge that's raised by the star's tide, and that can be dissipated. So dissipating the energy of that bulge in the equilibrium tide picture means that you have a m equals 2 bulge, and that bulge is displaced downstream in the frame of the fluid. So the fluid drags it along, and that has a few consequences. The spin in the orbit become parallel, so spin orbital alignment would be erased for the planet. It'll become synchronized, and these just will damp on a much longer time scale. And those time scales are pretty much just the ratio of angular momenta in the various components. It's really easy to align a planet, but not so easy to cause its eccentricity to decrease. For a hot Jupiter, like 3 days, give it a Q of 10 to the 6 or so. Okay, so during any of these, the frame of the fluid feels a time variable nature. There's shears and tidal heat will be generated. Okay, so that's the standard story we've heard so far, and now I'm gonna mix in some orbital dynamics. And the result will be Cassini states, it's called. So the way I like to lead up to it is to say, suppose that instead of being constant in space like I was showing before, the angular momentum of the orbit processes around some other axis. So this would be the invariable plane, for instance, of the entire system of planets and spins. And so that could be a result of another planet that's not coplanar, the first planet, or a rotational bulge on the star, which is not aligned with the orbit. So there's a constant inclination there. Then the spin of the planet is trying to align with the orbit, but that orbit is a moving target. It's processing around. So this parallelization timescale that I mentioned earlier no longer gets you to the moving target. The target's moving faster than that, so it goes to some other obliquity, theta, and that obliquity is called the Cassini state.
So, strictly speaking, the Cassini states are for rigid bodies.
Okay, the question is, are they only for rigid bodies? The answer is not in my language. and I'll come back to that next slide, where I talk about the movement.
Does that have to do with that, being able to sustain a fixed formation?
Briefly, the moon keeps one face towards us, and that's you need the permanent quadrupole to do that. In sort of generalized Cassini states, or Cassini states where there's no permanent quadrupole moment, then you won't become synchronous either. So I'll show you what the pseudo-synchronous rate is. All right, so but let's first do the obliquity. If I set this inclination to 0.1 in radians, so about 5 degrees, then there's a series of different values for what the obliquity becomes, and that rate is those values are determined by the orbital precession rate, which is this guy, and the spin precession rate, which is alpha. Now, alpha, really the spin precession depends on how far you tilt over. If you tilt over all the way to 90 degrees, the spin precession rate is very long. So I took out a cosine of the obliquity here. But that's the normalization. Okay, so what it says is if the orbit's precessing very slowly, then the spin does have time to find the moving target, and the obliquity it finds will be zero. Now, Stampiel over here is the one who gave these numbers and called them Cassini states. But so this is kind of the trivial one, right? The non-trivial one is when the orbit is precessing very quickly, and in that case, you will find a different theta. In particular, think about this orbit moving around very, very quickly. Then on time average, it looks like it's just along that direction. So then the spin will align up with that average direction. Yeah, at any moment, the orbit is off to the side. So you see why theta should equal I on that side. And then there's a resonant behavior in between. If you started way up here and slowed down the orbital precession, then you'll follow a path up this way. So now we have the moon. The moon, it's close to the ecliptic. It's off the ecliptic by 5 degrees. It's being precessed very quickly by the sun in 18 years. And spin can't keep up with that. G is much bigger than alpha. But nevertheless, so you're over here a little bit. Theta is a little bit bigger than I, and it's, I think the theta is 6.5 degrees. So this is what Cassini noticed in the 1600s and why they're called Cassini states. So the laws that Cassini came up with, these are just like Kepler's laws. You saw it happening in the sky.
The orbit and the rotational rate are equal. And that is the part of Cassini states which depends on the permanent quadrupole. Theta is constant, as I just explained, it's 6.5 degrees. And these angles are coplanar. I'll get back to that in a moment.
Well, here, I'll show you. These are the same angles from before. And it just so happens that in this rotating frame, they're going to line up. And I guess there's symmetry properties which explain why it just so happens that way. So now I'm going to show you the moving version of this. Yeah, sure. Yes.
So suppose you start with state number 2, initially at theta equal to I. And then you're going to gradually change, you want to change z.
Right.
Gradually you're saying the state could evolve along that line.
That's right.
And so that depends on how fast you're changing z.
Yeah, if you change.
You change it adiabatically somehow.
Yeah, if you change, if you just torque it straight, that's nothing. But if you spiral in, so yeah, if you change it much faster than its oscillating timescale, then that's not adiabatic. It won't do this. That's right. It would probably jump to 1. But you notice that it just keeps being connected all the way up here, which means you can have one or the other depending on your time history of your system. Okay, so this is, you know, a month of pictures repeated over and over again, and of course the main sweeping is the sun going over it. But you see the surface rocking due to the eccentricity of the moon. You see this side and that side more or less during the month, but you also see it tipping back, and that's the 6 degrees of obliquity that the moon has. So you can see why Cassini was able to see that in the 1600s. Okay, so you can put these precessions into a code and integrate it, and that's what I've done here. The equations I can show you at the end, it's just a precession. What's in here actually is a misaligned star. The constants that I chose were very crazy. They weren't physical. I just wanted to illustrate the behavior.
You do have a flattening of the star?
Yeah, so this particular calculation has flattening of the star, flattening of the planet, tidal bulges, dissipation, equilibrium tide style. The orbits are circular. There's only one orbit here. It's circular. Okay. So again, here's our coordinate system.
Now I'm gonna
also have a azimuthal angle defined, and that I said on the last slide that these three become coplanar. These three vectors are coplanar.
That's where the Cassini states are. But now we have an extra torque, which is the dissipation. Dissipation causes torque, and that will displace the spin vector away from that plane. The dissipation causes you to find the Cassini state 2 in this case. And this plane is just projecting that the tip of that vector onto the plane defined by putting z along the orbital axis and putting the precession angle
in the yz plane. Okay, so then dissipation causes you to spiral in. If a dissipationless system will keep you on a constant Hamiltonian bean, but dissipation brings you to the fixed point. Okay, and so then these are just the angles between the different vectors. They all find a constant on the time scale of the synchronization time, a million years or so. Okay, so, but this doesn't really work. I said I used kind of crazy values for that. If you use more realistic values or you integrate longer, the tides become stronger and stronger. So here's showing how this doesn't work forever. Maybe I should show you back here. This bean spiraled in, but it didn't come right to x equals 0, which would be the coplanar state. It came to a slightly offset place. And that offset place, you can work out find the fixed point of all these different torques, where the derivatives are all 0. And that fixed point, I have an equation that just does it to first order in phi. So that's this equation, but I have the actual evolution here too. So it does a pretty good job, but then when this becomes of order pi over 2, Cassini state 2 no longer holds on to it. So this kind of evolution has the theta of 80 degrees or 90, close to 90 degrees, and the relative contribution of the tidal torque pulls it away from coplanar. If you get too far off coplanar, then the state's no longer stable, and you go down to Cassini state 1. So originally I looked into this because Wynn and Holman put it forward as a idea for puffing up hot Jupiters, many of which have radii too big for the evolution calculations. So the idea there is that holding it in this funny spin state causes you to couple the orbital energy into the planet, tidal friction. And that can cause your
semi-major axis to decrease while in Cassini state 2. But then once it breaks out, it's in Cassini state 1, and then it's a really negligible effect. So tidal heating ends if you try to do a self-consistent
calculation. So I would say Cassini states for hot Jupiters could be active, but you need to turn off dissipation. And by turn off dissipation, you need a Q, a big Q of more than 10 to the 9, about 10 to the 9 or more. If you have too small a Q, then this angle will be more than pi over 2 and it won't be stable. Now, with a Q of 10 to the 9 or greater, which would cause it to stabilize, tidal heating is not rapid enough to puff up a planet.
Because that number 10 to the 9, that must depend on the orbital period, I guess?
Yeah, it depends on lots of things. For a longer orbital period, more than 3 days, I forget what the scaling is, but yeah, it's a less severe restriction, of course. So a Jupiter at 0.2 AU would be fine. It would, if you had two planets and one of them were at 0.2 AU, it should be in. It could find a Cassini state. I should say that the planets in the solar system, of course, you have Mercury, and it's tidally evolved. It's evolved down to the 3-2 spin-orbit resonance. But its orbit is being perturbed by the planets. And it does find a Cassini state in that it's a much more general system. I just have one precessional timescale here. There's lots of things buffeting Mercury's orbit. So for that, Stan Peale has done really nice recent work, and a long time ago too, in which he put Cassini states around the solar system, not just for the moon. Okay, so are there any other questions on Cassini states?
So you're saying...
You can come back to it, of course.
It's possible that some of the exoplanets that we're seeing are in Cassini states.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's just HG-209 is not.
It's probably not.
But how
and it's not going to be puffed up by that.
Well, if you admit that your... Okay, is there any scenario possible, I guess it's a general question, where you would say my average Q is a medium, but it's highly dependent on resonances, and most of the time I have a Q of 10 to the 9.
Yeah, right.
Can you work out a scenario like this?
Instantaneously, if I put it there, and you're in one of those valleys of Q, it could stay. But then it hits a resonance, it's kicked out of Cassini state 2, and then it stays at 1 the rest of the time. Yeah.
Dan mentioned Wynn and Bohm to be a very clever idea. When the system is far away from the star, when the planet is very far away from the star, Cassini state 2 is stable, and the tide will take effect in the system. Cassini state 2. But as the planet moves in, the precession rate goes up. So the Cassini state 2 tips over, and the planet stays there. You know, we'll go over. Okay. And they hypothesize that indeed, if it's liquid near 90 degrees, yet I'm going around the star very close, the tide will be very big, and there'll be lots of dissipation. You can puff the star up. The thing they neglected was the tide is still slowing the planet down. So in order to, if it stays synchronously rotating, they'd have a viable scheme. But the fact that the planet slows down makes the Cassini state too unstable, and it moves over to the places that Stan indicated, and zips over to Cassini state 2 and stands up very quickly, and the dissipation stops.
Right, I forgot to emphasize this. There's a new pseudosynchronous another term that comes into the pseudosynchronous equation in the style of Hutt, which is you need to, theta is again in the obliquity, and so if theta equals zero, then this is two down here, and the planet spin rate equals the orbital rate. But if you have a non-zero theta, then you have this behavior.
This is right. Okay, so it's something like this. It's very shallow at the top, but then when you get up to this is again theta, and you get up to a radian of obliquity, then it starts turning on sort of, and it turns over to zero at pi over two. Okay. So if you don't have a permanent quadruple moment, then you'll follow this curve. And it's still possible to find this equilibrium even at a non-spin synchronous state, but and it'll find this state at about the same rate that it'll find the obliquity solution. So there is a self-consistent solution possible. It's just you're not going to heat up hot Jupiters that way. Okay, so let's go to a really extreme example of tides. HD80606 is discovered, I think, 2001 by Mayfield. And here's their radio velocity data and the best fit. now the sign is a, to say the least. Here's a planet that thinks it's a comet. So here's the phased up version. Of course, what this spike means is that the planet's traveling very fast at some moment. It's zooming through Periastron. And Laughlin et al. Had a measurement of the planet as it swung through Periastron with Spitzer. And Langton and Laughlin put together very simplified compared to last week's discussion of atmospheric dynamics, but a nice simulation of what the planet looks like as it flies through. So what's really nice about this system is that we have a theory for why it's so eccentric, which is that there happens to be nearby a common proper motion star. So it's a bound binary star companion of about the same mass as the host star, about one solar mass. And it's about 1,000 AU away. So that almost certainly doesn't affect planet formation process much at all. But after the planet forms, it can have a large effect on its orbit. So there's about 40 subsystems known with interior planets orbiting one star and then a companion star. And here, a few years ago, this is old, only 30 systems compared to the ones now known. I ordered them by the separation of the star. So in close is where people are worried about forming the planets in the first place. How far the stars that are 10 to 4 AU away don't have much of a dynamical influence. But stars in the middle region probably only affect the planet once it's already formed. So how does it affect it? There's a secular approximation where you, in celestial mechanics, where you take all the orbits as if they were weighted rings. This is the conceptual understanding of it. So consider an external binary star that is just like a weighted ring on the outside, and think about how a planet orbiting in the potential caused by that ring, how that orbit warps and precesses and eccentricity fluctuates. So one result is that since this ring is a fixed potential, it's not a time variable situation, and so the orbital energy of the planet doesn't change. And that also means that the semi-major axis is conserved. However, there's really interesting behavior when the mutual inclination between the orbits gets above 40 degrees or close to mutually perpendicular. There's a magic number in which if you start out with both orbits circular, if you have an inclination above this magic number, the inner orbit becomes eccentric. And as I said, there's precessions to the orbital orientation as well. Okay, so how about the spin orbit alignment? Back to tides a bit. We have the star, which is oblate again, and makes an angle with respect to the orbit. And if the planet is in really close, it feels the bulge much stronger than it does the binary companion, and therefore the theta will be constant. C will be constant. Whereas if the orbit is wide, it just notices the star as a point mass, and I will be approximately constant. And so psi will fluctuate. So that gives you a diagnostic. If ever the binary companion was a stronger influence on the planet's orbit than the host star's bulge. Okay, so getting back to this high inclination regime, there's Kozai cycles. So this is 1962. Kozai wrote a paper on asteroids. In the mid-90s, people realized it was actually a paper on dynamics. and started applying it to everything under the sun and over the sun. And it launched off. So what does this correspond to? It corresponds to people starting applying it to extrasolar planets, the black hole systems, et cetera, et cetera. If a theorist wants some eccentricity in their two-body system, they will invoke an inclined third body and get Kozai cycles to give them the eccentricity they want. So in particular, there was a planet 16 Cygni, which was highly eccentric, 0.6 or so. And this was back in the mid-90s when such things were not widely realized that planets should be on eccentric orbits. To this day, it's not a completely solved problem why the planets are eccentric in general. Whereas our solar system examples are nicely circular. But Kozai cycles is a good way because this big V indicates that there's an A, which means that there's a binary companion in this system. And we don't know exactly what its orbital period is. So depending on its torque, it could cause the eccentricity to fluctuate on a short time scale or a longer time scale, but it'll probably fluctuate regardless. And along with those eccentricity cycles come inclination cycles. And so there's a out of phase trading between inclination and eccentricity.
Well, what happens if you replace the planet with its natal fluid disk?
Replace the planet with its natal fluid disk?
In other words, the same effect on fluid disk?
I get you. So it's a good lead in here because here's a plot. Come back in a moment. He's saying, how come before the planet forms, say, the protoplanetary disk doesn't get all warped and destroyed even by the binary
companion? Could you form the planet that you want to preserve by the Kozai cycle from the fluid disk in a traditional manner, or would the disk be torqued out of that by the presence of
the planet? Did everyone hear that? I'm invoking that the planet will form in a highly inclined state, then feel the binary companion and get eccentric. And Brad's saying, well, if the disk is there and it's highly inclined and you're going to form a planet out of it, won't it feel the binary companion and flatten out or something? Even rip apart, accrete onto the central star, something before planet formation happens. And I'm going to answer that in a couple sentences. So suppose you start out with a circular planet and introduce a binary companion with a certain initial inclination. Then the standard equation gives you a certain eccentricity maximum to these cycles. So here you start at 60 degrees and you get up to 0.7. So that should be readable off of here. Okay, but there's a competition here because the main thing that's happening in Kozai cycles is that the axis of the planet is precessing. Rosemary keeps on telling me it's epsilon advance. So I will say epsilon advance. It's also called pericentric precession. But if GR is precessing the pericenter at a fast rate, this will get wiped out. It'll just average over too quickly to excite the eccentricity much. So if the GR precession rate competes with the time scale of Kozai cycles left to their own devices, then the eccentricity maximum won't be as high for a given initial usual inclination. Okay, so that's what GR would do. Now, imagine you have a bunch of nested rings, which is my conception of a fluid disk out of which the planet will form. The fluid rings precess each other through gravity, through pressure, and they do so on a quite fast time scale. So they're going to act as like a fast precession here, and they will not allow Kozai cycles to happen while the disk persists. And then, so So in other words, they will precess nodally. The whole disk will precess because of the binary companion. But maybe on a long time scale, maybe a few million years, it won't precess once in a few million years and you've already formed your planet. If the binary star is close enough, I'm invoking that the disk can stay as a coherent unit, still inclined, without flattening out. Now this is, you have to do this in detail.
Yeah, I buy the contribution. I would call your attention to a related or exactly the same situation between centric disk and M31.
Yeah.
Which Scott had a model for, and he required the disk to be self-gravitating in order to have all, basically to have the disk have a single shape or radii and precess together, because it wasn't self-gravitating. The rate of precession would be different at different radii, and things would start getting hectic.
Now, I don't know the model so well. Is it externally driven?
Yeah, it's basically...
It's just a coherent self-oscillation, right?
Yes, but in external potential. But what I'm worried about, but as I understand it, the reason for self-gravity was to make sure that the thing processes essentially as a rigid body.
Right.
Okay. Yes, and that would be my concern here, is that different radii might process at different rates, in which case, it's very rich.
I don't doubt that the problem is very rich.
And to work with circumstances.
I think when you have a guess, these people have looked at this in binary system.
Yeah.
And you do expect these bending modes and some alignment after a while.
So, right. Yeah, the consequence of that is that the disk will damp down to the equatorial.
That's
point.
Right. That's right.
So imagine, though, that the binary companion has a 1,000 AU orbit.
Yeah, so time scale is not.
Its orbit is a million years.
Yeah.
And its cycle effects are a lot longer than that, many, many orbits. So. There's a couple different answers to the objection, and as you say, it's very rich in general. But I think there is a nice parameter space where Kozai cycles can happen.
But yeah, that doesn't seem to be an outrageous calculation to do.
Yeah, someone should do it.
Well, in fluid disk, it's hard to imagine the centric holding. Where you live there. But you can get this sort of like Barney Peterson type effect where you have
that's right.
Transition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Some regions align with the external object, some regions transition into this region.
Right.
I think it can happen in principle. The translation hasn't been
done. Eccentricity, you think?
Sure, but the combined dynamics of eccentric and warp disks has not been investigated. That's right, the theory of warp disks has only been developed for circular orbits, and the theory of eccentric disks is only going to be done for coplanar disks.
That's your next project.
Okay, so that's subtle friction. Now,
maybe I should interject a comment.
Yeah, sure.
Of the cosine effect, it has a very interesting consequence. As you know, there's been hundreds now of irregular satellites down the planets. And those come in from all angles, so you'd expect a uniform distribution of inclinations of those satellites. But there is an absence of satellites between 40 degrees and 140 degrees. Remember Dan's limit there, 39 degrees. Because above 40 degrees, you get the Kozai oscillations. The eccentricities can grow, bring the periaps down into the regular satellite region, and they're kicked out. And so we see this paucity of satellites, which is explained by the Kozai interaction.
There's other, I mean, of course, since it was developed for asteroids, there are asteroids in the Kozai resonance. And there's one called Kozai that's in the Kozai resonance. And a nice paper showing that Shoemaker Levy 9 probably executed a Kozai cycle or two before hitting Jupiter. It's captured from heliocentric orbit, went through a few cycles, and then hit Jupiter. So, yeah, they're fun, and I think they're true. It's not just a theory construct.
That's real. It's something you can look at and see.
So I believe that there's a Russian paper by Lee.
Yes.
I haven't looked at it, but this I don't know if it does much the same thing. So it'd be interesting to see how many citations he gets.
Yeah, Leo is starting to get off the mark with citations, just because dynamicists starting to feel guilty for only praising Kozai.
Well, we don't even invite Mr. Kozai along to our meetings. I think we should do that one day.
He's still around. Still alive.
Yeah.
He is. Yeah. Yeah, but he's just over there and we're using him.
I hear he enjoys the publicity. Wouldn't you? Okay, so let's get into tides. If the barycenter really is going down towards the star, there will be tidal friction. So here's a model. It's the Eagleton equations, which is like the time shifted equilibrium bulges that we heard about the other day. It's not dynamical tides, and it takes a physically motivated but still a time shift in the bulge, and that has all the same effects that I mentioned before about how the spin aligns and synchronizes and the eccentricity is down. So here in this panel, what happens? One Kozai cycle happens on a 10 million year time scale, up to an observed eccentricity. Oh, I should say, I'm starting the planet at 5 AU hollow Jupiter. And therefore, at that distance, GR is not as important for suppressing this effect. If the planet started at 1 AU, it would suppress the Kozai effect. So if you want Kozai cycles to work for this particular planet, you'd have to start it out near Jupiter's orbit and have a ridiculous eccentricity at some point. Okay, so yeah, right at that peak eccentricity, the barycenter is right near the star, and the semi-major axis changes. Here, for the first few Kozai cycles, the spin transfers the orbit and the orbit widens. But once it comes to equilibrium, the orbit's shrinking quite fast at some point. So here I put a diamond at its current orbital semi-major axis and its current eccentricity. So you can make a track that goes through the currently observed position. The inclinations I showed as before, they oscillate out of phase with the eccentricity. And this is the inclination between the two orbital planes. At high eccentricity, that corresponds to inclination minimum. So tides tend to seal in that inclination minimum. And this process tends to give you final mutual inclinations of around 40 degrees or around 140 degrees. It's kind of like clearing out the irregular satellites, but not killing them off, saving them. They're sweeping them up into the bin, 40 and 140 degrees. And then something that's observable is the spin orbit alignment angle, which oscillates wildly, but settles out to something. And at the current epoch, I should say, it has settled out to what it's going to be.
Maybe I'm supposed to say, what's the last angle? Is that rapid oscillation?
This oscillation is not the same time scale as this. Left hand plots. So the time scales here are they're both good years, but here it's 0.06.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And there's also 5 good years. Okay. I could have made logarithmic plots, but I like this two panel thing better because then it shows that these are actually spaced evenly.
So, binary companion is at what distance for this system?
This side took 1,000 AU.
1,000 AU. And then that last panel with that angle, it's the angle between the
spin of the star.
Star, okay.
And the orbit of the planet.
Okay.
Yeah. And here the planet itself is at Cassini state 1, meaning very close to the spin orbit alignment.
What Q value?
What Q value? It is Eagleton's effective Q value. Since the semi-major axis changes so much, it sweeps through a huge range. I picked a value of that constant to make it decreasing For a given system, everything is fine-tuned.
Of course, so, but you don't have a feel for what works?
Yeah. So, okay, here's the feeling I have. This gets down to about six-day orbit once it's totally circularized, and it's a three Jupiter mass planet, I think. So if you look on the asymmetry versus period plot, those things of that are not all that circularized. So you do need a pretty efficient Jupiter.
And this time-shifted equilibrium bulge, so it's basically like a partial bulge, or sort of a deformation. Right? And then you're accounting for the fact that it doesn't exactly track the...
Right, it's just carried along by the fluid.
So can you use that actually to have an effective permanent mass quadrupole?
Because of the time-shift?
You need to... If you wanted to put in a permanent quadrupole
for the whole Jupiter,
you need to keep track of what angle the longitude of the planet. This in the secular approximation, we don't do that. So it would be a lot more complicated code.
I told
it's
you.
It's certainly
I
possible.
Code,
Rosemary has the code on your hard drive. Rosemary got more than it. Okay, so I want to argue for HD 80606 that there's a secular resonance. A resonance, just like the Cassini state stuff, it's a resonance between an orbit-orbit interaction and an orbit-spin interaction. And it's a secular thing. It's not like Mercury's 3-2 resonance. So, there's a certain time scale for precession of this. The singular momentum with the frequency g, and then the coupling due to the oblateness of the star, which left to its own devices would give you a constant spin orbit angle at a different frequency, alpha. As the planet tidally dissipates and gets closer to the star, the orbit-orbit interaction gets weaker, that frequency goes down, and the spin-orbit interaction gets stronger, that frequency goes up. So we're going to have Cassini state type interaction. Here the Cassini states themselves are labeled 1, 2, and 4, and this is on the same XY plane I showed earlier. But now I have remember that the orbit is here, the invariable plane is over here, and the spin travels along the beam. Tidal dissipation causes the orbit to shrink, so then the beams change shape. If you do it adiabatically, you would keep the same area. You would change the beam number or whatever, but you would keep the same area in that to the next panel. But this stable island gets smaller and smaller, so eventually you no longer can stay oscillating around Cassini state 2. And that causes you to kick into the region around Cassini state 1 or 4. And that's a probabilistic thing, depending on what phase the area of the beam, what phase you are at when the area of the beam kicked you off that island. So, but anyway, there's two possible spin orbit alignments for HD 80606 in the story that I showed before. So I ran it with slightly different tidal dissipation parameters many times and built up statistics that show that you either get kicked towards Cassini state 1 or towards on the outside, towards Cassini state 3. And those rates seal in. So this is my prediction for the spin orbit alignment of that particular system, which is a transiting system, and Rostrum and Belkin work is being done on. This is not a very strict prediction for this one system because you don't get this value. You get a sky projected version of this value. So really, this spreads out towards the sides, and unfortunately, for one system, it's not a very strict prediction. But for many systems, you'll get the same characteristic. So this is for a calculation where I didn't worry about whether it's adiabatic or not. So instead of two spikes, you get a big spread. But nevertheless, I think I understand now that second peak up here and the distribution of psi angles. So this is a prediction for Kozai cycles of tidal friction, and that can be tuned for a little bit according to the mass of the planet, say, and the binary companion. But in general, I expect this shape with retrograde orbits are quite possible in this scenario. Disk migration, however, there hasn't been a whole lot of work on predicting this, even though disk migration is the standard story of how we get Hutchie curves. So I'm just going to put the delta function. and then there's planet-planet scattering. The only real calculation of this that ends in Hutchie curves was Nagasawa et al. And they predict basically an isotropic spin orbit angles.
So they must have some Kozai in their simulation.
Yeah, so Kozai is in the title of their paper even. And so their vision is that the planets are scattering, and the scattering produces high inclinations sometimes. And those high inclinations give you secular effects, not just strong chaotic effects. But at its core is a planet-planet scattering calculation. Then there's mean motion resonances. They can also pump up the mutual inclination, as Thomas and Lissauer showed quite nicely through mini integrations. So time's up, I guess. But so I will say one sentence on each of the next slides. Here we go. Tides do not realign star because the planet will get swallowed at the same time that the spin orbit alignment will go away due to tides. The spin orbit alignment can be measured spectroscopically for transiting planets, but only in sky projection.
You're sticking to it.
The observations of transiting planets so far show many that are spin orbit aligned, but a number which are very misaligned. A Bayesian calculation of this suggests that a much better model for understanding the distribution of spin orbit angles is one that invokes a very bimodal distribution rather than a single, very smooth distribution in spin orbit angles. And that's it. A couple sentences on this slide. Here's just the topics that I talked about. And I didn't touch on some very interesting things that I think have been looked at a little bit, but there's still a lot more to do. Not that there aren't on these topics, but these are things that I think can tell us a lot about either tidal dissipation or close-in planets. And the interaction between tides and the dynamics. So there's tides and mean motion resonant planets. I did show that Thomas and Lissauer think that mean motions pushed to their extreme can give you mutual inclinations. And then you could get spin orbit misalignment that way. Thomas is in the audience this time. I could say you and Tremaine. Some of the theory of this was given by Turkheim and Papaloizu. The basic idea is that if two planets are in mean motion resonance, then they have a certain period ratio. But tidal dissipation tends to take energy out of the interior, the closer in planet, and that causes its orbit to shrink, pulling it out of tide of mean motion resonance. So I think tides will generally break mean motion resonances. And this has been demonstrated numerically for the 14 and 44 day planets near a 3-2-1 resonance in 55 Cancri. And there's a system of three super Earths, periods of 4, 9, and 20 days. Looks like it initially was in a 42-to-1 resonance, but tides acted to drag it out of there. And Dog is working on that. I'm not sure he's going to be the first author, but he and his collaborators are working on that. And then on Tuesday at coffee, I talked a lot about that idea that tides will bring you into abscisal alignment between two eccentric planets. Rather than damping the interior planet to eccentricity zero, it will damp into a finite eccentricity in which the two orbits have aligned periapsis. So Rosemary has the most detailed papers on this, and Batykin has applied this to GJ 4 through 6, which has an anomalously high eccentricity. It's a Neptune, which you would infer a Q of something like 10 to 7, if not for some dynamical interaction. And also he did it for P13. So I think there's a lot of, like these systems and HG80606, there's lots of individual systems that it's really fun to try to model with the combination of dynamics and tides. And in a population sense, it's important to make hot Jupiters. I think it is a second channel for making hot Jupiters that is now seems to be populated given the spin orbit results. So now I really will stop talking.
When you start talking once again, we'll have to clap again.
Maybe this is the fun.
Lots of questions.
One quick word of explanation, I guess, since you mentioned doing this with mean motion resonances. The thing that we found you have to be there is you have to have very little damping, at least on the inner planets. So, but I mean, that could happen, that you might envision the scenario where
you mean damping from the disk?
Yeah, we have damping from the disk, and there's sort of an inner hole, so it's really only the outer planets being pushed and being damped. So in a situation like that, or maybe if you had multiple, like more than two planets, then you might get the eccentricities up to the sort of 0.6-ish area where you then flip into this inclination divergence.
Okay, so one of the most fun systems for mean motion resonances is GJ876. And Lee and Peel show that if you start with circular planets on coplanar orbits, shove them together, they will both the eccentricities of both planets will go up. But it'll go up in such a way that the system remains stable and librating with a very small angle. And so what Ed is saying is that if you keep pushing that and don't have damping that moderates it, then the coplanar situation will go unstable and it'll mutual inclinational features. So that's what Thomas and Lissauer did.
That's sort of interesting. You know, we've done a lot of these integrations and find that you only get into the inclination resonances after you get into the high eccentricities. Did you find that as well?
Yeah, there didn't seem to be a different way.
And I don't know whether it's the changing precession rates that do that or not. I'm not sure exactly why that occurs.
Yeah, we're still not entirely comfortable that we understand all of what's going on. I mean, in some ways, it's almost analogous to cosine that's going on, but I don't think that's what it is. I mean, if you look at the resonance angle for 4-2, it's temporarily in there, just enough, and you get a very fast kick, and you're going to get this instrument, and then you're going to fall over again.
So the cosine resonance, as I presented it today, is only in the secular approximation, average over both orbits. Yet in the solar system, for KBOs outside of Neptune's orbit, ones that are in mean motion resonance can also be in cosine resonance in the sense that their periapsis stays off the plane of the solar system. And so there can be such mixed things. But I think the qualitative nature of that cosine resonance is conceptually different even than the one that we talked about.
In considering the spin orbit alignment, Do we need to worry about the possibility that the disk out of which the planets form might be tilted relative to the star by a stellar flyby or a binary companion in a tilted orbit?
Yeah, I'm worried about that.
But I guess also the star disk torques matter whether you can realign the system after such.
But doesn't the fact that you have several systems that are aligned tell you that?
It could explain some cases.
But the majority are, you're the dominant fraction that are aligned. So doesn't that tell you have to start a line somewhere? No?
So the time history of this is almost like this plot. Like originally, people were measuring very nice alignment angles and saying, this gives you implications for forming in a disk, which also sets the spin of the star.
Right, I guess what I'm at.
You need two separate scenarios.
Exactly, I'm thinking of
one scenario with a tweak.
Exactly.
That's right.
That's what, yeah. So if you, that would be disks.
Have you told
and if it's disks, it suggests you start a line. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I interpret this as disks, yeah. But if you don't want to worry about Kozai cycles and tidal friction, or you have some reason to think, like Brad's reason why that shouldn't happen in nature, then yeah, there's probably some modification of disk migration that can give you these guys.
Any information about binarity for the?
Yeah, okay, binarity. So HD606 has a companion. So do a few of these guys. This is the very best aligned system, and it has a companion at about 300 AU. Right in that sweet spot where I said, oh, because I said, so, you know, if you ever came to me, and I talk about this guy a lot, and then there's a lot. HAPP-1 has a companion, it's aligned. And HAPP-7 has a radial velocity drift. That could be a very close in star or a second planet. I think that's all I know. Maybe TRIS-2 has a companion. Right now, there's no real correlation between its alignment and binary.
Our correlation of these angles is orbital period and temporal.
Correlations between this and the orbital period. I don't think there are any. Of course, this is kind of a single case. I don't think there's a correlation.
Okay. I'm wondering if we can use some of the situations that we know of in the solar system now to apply to extrasolar systems, in the sense that Mimas and Tethys, I think, are in a 4-2 inclination resonance, and you know, maybe Kozai didn't actually get them in that resonance. Or, you know, it's like, what is the origin of that resonance? And also, I think Enceladus has this secondary spin orbit resonance, this 3-1. Carolyn Porco came out with a paper a few years ago about that. And I think that's similar to the alpha and the G that you had on one of the plots earlier, I think.
But these are in motion resonances, right?
No, no, no. Well, the Enceladus one is in an orbit with the Dione, but it also has this resonance about its spin corresponding with its the libration due to its oblateness. So similar to what you had earlier. So maybe there's some connection
there's
there.
There's tons to do in satellite systems, and that's kind of maybe this is something we can do in this forum, because we're supposed to be wedding planetary sciences and exoplanets, so that'd be awesome. And I'd love to have a breakout session on spin orbit misalignment. So maybe Wednesday of next week, I propose. But if you're interested in that, talk to me and make sure that we'll all be here on that day.